Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak, and we really appreciate you taking time today to join us for another full hour of Midrats. And as a reminder for those that are with us live, if you'd like to, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you can find the chat room. If there are some observations that you would like to make about the show, or there are some questions that you would like for us to direct to our guest, that's a great place to go ahead and put that in there, because we'll be monitoring it during the course of the show, and we're more than happy to steal your good ideas. Also, if you have to hop off halfway through the show and you want to see what you missed, or you just want to catch up on some previous editions of Midrats, you can get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can go over to iTunes and subscribe to the free podcast. And hey, while you're there, if you wanted to give us a 5-star review, we'd appreciate that. That would help get the show a little extra exposure. But enough of the cheap, cheesy marketing. Let's go ahead and get on with the show. This hour, we're going to back up a little bit, and we're going to look at some of the big pixels that undergird and support our entire DoD structure. We're going to talk about procurement strategies and the choices that we make inside our organizations and our bureaucracies that everything else follows from. And if you look at the course of the last three decades, especially at procurement side of the house, for the world's largest military structure, when it comes to weapons development and strategic foresight, it hasn't been what you could describe as a stellar record that we can all be proud of. And what we're going to do is kind of as a central starting point, using his latest, not one of his latest articles, one of his recent articles at the National Interest, The Real Threat to America's Military, and It's Not China, Russia, or Iran. We're going to have on for the full hour returning guest, Professor Robert M. Farley, Ph.D. He is also the author of the recent book, Grounded, The Case for Abolishing the United States Air Force. Rob teaches defense and security courses at the Patterson School of Diplomacy at the University of Kentucky. And if you like what you hear, in addition to the national interest, you can also find him where he blogs over at Information Dissemination and Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Rob, welcome back to Midrats.
Hi, I'm happy to be back. Thanks for having me.
Hey, and as a scene setter here for our listeners who have been very naughty and have not read your article yet, it's when you look at the U.S. military in very broad strokes, on this planet we're the only nation that has a true global fleet of nuclear supercarriers. We're the only nation that has global reach with heavy bombers. And we're the only nation that, with a little bit of planning and some time, we can bring divisions right across your beach and have them drop from the sky. But as you outline in your article and a few other things you've written recently, you don't really see that as our greatest national security threat. What are your thoughts about what is that big threat out there for our ability to have our military carry out our national interest?
Well, what I talk about in the article, and this is related to the argument I made in the book about the Air Force, I think the article develops some of the trends, some of the thoughts that are in the Air Force book, and develops them in ways which don't necessarily have the same kind of antagonistic view of the world as the book's title seems to suggest. The big problem, I think, that we have in terms of military procurement, and it's a problem that's not unique to the United States, but it's one that has become more and more obvious over the past few decades, is that our procurement system, our system of deciding what we want for weapons, is built around the preferences of these three and a half gigantic bureaucratic organizations, the services, and that despite trying to reform that system in a lot of different ways, and the 1986, the Goldwater Nichols reforms are the biggest effort there, but there have been a lot of other attempts to reform the system procurement that we have, that the way we go about deciding the weapons we want is still too tied to the ideas that each service has with respect to the kind of weapons they need in order to do their jobs. But as you suggest, the global responsibilities that we have are inevitably and invariably joint responsibilities. There are inevitably responsibilities that cross service boundaries. But the problem we have is that the way we think about and the way we approach purchasing what's necessary for those capabilities remains tied to the services. And there's a second and related problem that even when we try to reach out and develop programs that are joint programs and we call joint programs when you put joint in the name, that somehow those projects tend to work out even worse when we try to build systems and try to find systems that the three services are going to be able to use together, are going to be able to use at least individually on their own. And so my argument is that really the problem is one that's difficult to reform with small bore reforms. It requires a really large reform back on the order of a 1947 rather than a 1986 in terms of rethinking what we want the origins and the core of our services to look like and how they are then going to start thinking about the weapons that they're going to want to buy.
So if we throw out the National Security Act of 1947, we end up with an army, a navy, and I guess the Coast Guard. How does that significantly change in terms of, as you see it, our procurement process? I mean, we've had a number of instances with the F-111 to the Joint Strike Fighter now where somebody in the Department of Defense has decided that we ought to unify as much as possible some of the aircraft we buy or some other equipment we buy, the H-60 helicopter being a good example of that. What would change? How would you envision a change in the way we approach procurement if we went back to a pre-1947 sort of structure?
Right. Well, part of the story here has to do with what happened, with how the procurement arguments or the arguments around procurement developed through the 1950s and into the 1960s. So if you go back to what the world looked like immediately after 1947, you had savage, nasty, horrible fighting between the services about what their procurement would look like. So it was public arguments between admirals and Air Force generals over whether it was a good idea to purchase the B-36 or a good idea to purchase supercarrier. And you had similar arguments with the Army. That wasn't the only one, just vicious, nasty arguments. The services in the early 1960s figure out that this kind of fighting is extremely destructive to the things that they want to do. And so they come to an accord essentially with themselves and eventually an accord with civilians in DOD where there is a virtually fixed amount of procurement funding that each service receives in a particular year. And that percentage does not change regardless of the changes in the international system, regardless of the changes in technology, the changes in the structure of threat. We always give this much to Army, this much to Navy, this much to Air Force, and this much to the Marine Corps. And then we attempt to fit, when we think about jointness and we think about DOD-wide projects, right, needs that the entire entire defense structure requires, like a large fighter bomber that the F-111 becomes, or like a single stealth fighter that services can use. It has the name joint, but it's pasted over this fractured system where each of the services has their own requirement, and so their own requirements, and so the price goes even higher because it's not truly joint. It's trying to figure out how you create something that looks very similar, like the current F-35, but it's really three different aircraft with three entirely different systems capabilities, right? But that's very little commonality among them. So it's the worst of all worlds, because it's pasting over a service-oriented procurement system. So part of the idea of going back to 1947, breaking things up and looking at it again, is to say, we don't have to have this tripartite fixed procurement budget, right? We can start thinking about whether we need to emphasize long-range capabilities versus emphasizing short-range combat capabilities. We can think about whether we can leave it within organizations to make decisions about whether they need to pursue short-range fighters or long-range bombers or other kinds of capabilities that don't then have to be fit onto this puzzle piece of a three different services that always get the same amount of money.
It always seemed to me that habit that, as you wrote, the static division of resources, that if you bring this habit out, even if you did knock out an Air Force, you would still have this ingrained habit. Is this mostly just a byproduct of stopping the conflict, said, hey, listen, let's just divvy it up evens, and then everybody can fight over their little piece of the pie? And does that potentially create more negative effects than it does positive effect? Because one of the great things about competition and creative friction and argument is it tends to create not quite a free market effect, but a more efficient allocation, because you have to actually fight and defend for things as opposed to getting your bucket of goo and then doing with it what you want.
Right, exactly. I think that there are some very positive salutary effects to inter-service conflict. And so that's why I think that countries that only have one service are often sort of really doing it wrong, because civilians should have access to the best arguments that senior military personnel have over what the weapon systems should look like. And in some sense, I think that there's a healthier climate of inter-service conflict in the United Kingdom, where you still do have sort of very nasty fights between the Army and the Air Force and the Navy in professional journals. Whereas you don't in the United States, because I think largely of this experience in the 1950s. And it's an area where joint reform, where 1986 was supposed to help this problem a lot, because we had identified what the really serious problems were, at least in operational terms, for how the services were working together. And 1986 was supposed to remedy not only those operational and tactical problems, but also give DOD sort of more of a bite with respect to how to get the services to work together on procurement. And in some sense, it's even made things worse, because it has increased the cartelization of the services, where they work together so much now that it's difficult to get them to compete in an above board way, in a way that civilians would like them to compete, right? Because you're right, it's about getting the best out of the defense dollar, not simply supporting siloed projects that come within a service, but that the other services are too afraid or too nervous to push back against.
Key elements, though, is the development of a national strategy, which is going to drive, in theory, the procurement process for all the services, out to some time in the future. I mean, have we seen at all recently a national strategy that people can go back to and say, this is why we're doing what we're doing, and that would help us be a little more cooperative or maybe counter the tendency of the services to be very stovepiped?
I think we've really struggled to do that. And part of that is just a relic of the democratic process. No one will argue that there have been, however you feel about either president, but no one will argue that there are not significant differences between the strategic outlook of the Bush and the Obama administration, or even that there were significant differences between the strategic outlook of the Clinton administration and the Bush administration. And that's appropriate, right? There should be politicized and political differences between how administrations and how presidents are going to approach national strategy. And it's good that we have those kinds of arguments. But even during the period of the Bush administration, it was well known and well understood that the Navy and the Air Force had entirely different priorities with respect to how they were thinking about the future than the Army did. And during the Obama administration, it's an open secret of the Army's discontent. It's not even a secret. It's openly known that the Army and, to a lesser extent, the Marine Corps, a great deal of discontent with respect to how the Navy and the Air Force were approaching questions like air land or air sea battle. And so even when we do seem to develop, or there does seem at least be some degree of strategic outlook, the services are continuing to pursue what they think their long-term interests are. So the strategic outlook matters, but the services are always going to try to figure out a way to maximize their own interests, maximize their own capabilities, get their piece of the pie within that strategic outlook.
We've touched on it a couple times already, and that's two of the major bureaucratic guiding principles of our military that date back to 1947, and then what wasn't known at the time, but just a few years before the collapse of the Soviet Union, Goldwater Nichols, in 1986. That has created our structure, the jointness, the purple, the JPME, how the chairman does or does not function. And interesting, and we talked about this last time we had you on, and Eagle One and I, we bring it up on a regular basis with our guests because it is it's kind of obvious to everybody that we really don't know how to address it. And what was interesting is one of the challenges has always been, who up at the Hill is going to help drive this if we are going to modernize now that we're halfway through the second decade of 21st century, something that might better meet our needs? Who in the Senate, who in the House? And we actually have seen recently some initial points being made, in this case by Senator McCain. Recently there was an event at the Brookings Institute, and I'll quote from Senator McCain right here. He said, quote, "There are many things that happened in the last 30 years that require adjustments to a fundamentally fine piece of legislation," unquote. It's funny. Senators always have to do that. They'll never say something's broken, needs to be fixed. They got to say how wonderful it is before they take it apart. And the other part of his quote is, quote, "I don't think that there's anyone who would say turn back the clock, but we swung in a direction where there are more layers of bureaucracy which ensure that there is no accountability for decisions. Plus, it's incredibly so simple that if anyone makes a decision, you can't hold them accountable." Is that, and we've all spilled gallons of ink with a lot of the programs, whether it's the F-35, whether it's LCS, whether it's FCS in the Army, or Comanche. Accountability. Who has been fired? Who is being held accountable? And I'll be careful not identifying the exact program because I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings because these are good people and hard jobs. But we have had one person in charge of an incredibly successful program that by default has become the foundation of our entire fleet, gets passed over for flag officer. But the program manager of the rolling of balsa wood train wreck that is the DDG 1000 program, he gets promoted to flag. Where is the accountability? And is that part of the issue we have, that not only does everybody get their fair cut of the pie, but we've developed, at least at the senior levels, that we obviously don't have at the company grade and the field grade officer levels, a system that you're too senior to fail, too senior to be held accountable, and as a result, there's no motivation for some personality types to do anything but ride it out till the PCS cycle moves them on to greener pastures.
I think that I celebrate the effort to increase accountability, increase personal accountability for the failure of major projects. But it's an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. It's hard for me even to envision. And part of this is because I'm far more distant from this and from these circles, because I'm out here in Kentucky and all I do is read. But
it's a good job. It's good work if you get it.
Good work if you get it. You know, the problem is that the people who are making decisions on a lot of these really key central issues are people who are very near the end of their careers anyway. And so there's a limited amount of certainly there are aspects that they can. Well, I mean, I guess the problem is two or even threefold. You know, one, you're talking about very senior people, and so the differences between being held accountable and being celebrated for doing something well or making a mistake really only matter for a very few years. And so that's one difficulty in terms of increasing accountability. Second is that even a failed project, a project that we identify as a clear, serious failure for America, is still wildly successful for a huge component of the defense industrial base, right? Because even if you pay a lot of money for a wasteful weapon, you're paying a lot of money and somebody's taking that money. And so somebody feels like they're really, you know, getting a lot of success out of this. And so there's always going to be a place for people who are pushing even failed projects, right? And so again, this isn't the Soviet Union where you can simply take a failed general out and have them shot after the project fails, right? They're always going to find a job somewhere, and often it'll be a better job than the one that they have. And you know, I think that again, part of the problem with the way that Goldwater Nichols tried to solve these issues of it correctly identified the service-based problems with how we were doing procurement, that too many capabilities were coming through the services. But it tried to solve those by creating these additional layers of bureaucracy, and that just clearly hasn't worked. It hasn't really made the situation better, and it may have made it worse. And I think that Senator McCain is quite right with respect to this problem, but it's also hard for me to see how, with the current level of bureaucratization in our services, you really solve that problem either. I mean, it seems like a really wicked problem if you're familiar with that term.
Well, let me ask you. I mean, in your article, you suggest taking apart what we currently have and folding the Air Force and changing some of the other aspects of the Navy, I think, and the Army, changing things around. What do we end up with? I mean, you want to kind of talk about what you see. You had the Army doing anti-ship missile sites along the coast and stuff like that, I think. And you know, how do things look if you were going to be the in charge of this process? What do you end up with?
Right. So, what I wanted to do in the article was to get away from this idea. So for years now, and really for decades, and it's not just in the United States, it's in other countries as well, we've had what amounts to a medium-based understanding of what the surfaces should look like, right? So we have air and sea and water. It seems entirely rational that we should have military services that do air and sea and water, right? And so we, like most countries in the world, you know, have a Navy, an Air Force, and an Army. That wasn't the way necessarily with the Soviet Union, but it's because they had very much more mission-oriented services like aerial defense or air defense and so forth. But it was the way we approached it. And the problem with that is that almost anything you do that's interesting or useful that a military will do is something that involves crossing those boundaries, right? Crossing those boundaries between the terrestrial, the celestial, and the maritime. And so it doesn't really work with missions that you need to cross those borders. And so my idea is we dispense with this terrestrial or this medium-based idea and start thinking about how we want our military services to look, based not on whether or not they're on sea or in the air, but rather this is what we want a service to do. We want a service to have the mission of tactical and operational excellence, right? The ability to defeat and destroy enemy military forces, to conduct operations against enemy military forces, which are geared towards the destruction of enemy forces. We want that on the one hand. That's right now we expect all of our services to do that, and we would in the future. But this is really sort of the animating idea behind a service. And then let's think about a second service. And the animating idea behind that service is more strategic. It's more of a strategic shaping service. So the idea is that this other service will be something that focuses very much on the management and the creation of dominance within the commons, whether they be the air commons, the sea commons, the space commons, or even the cyber commons, if we want to think about cyberspace in that way. And so have a strategic logic behind each service rather than what amounts to a geographic logic between each service. And then you let those two services sort through what capabilities they need internally with the advice and consent of civilians, of course, but you let them sort through internally what capabilities they need and make decisions about whether we need more armor or whether we need more air defense or whether we need more land attack cruise missiles or something along those lines without being bound to this 30%, 30%, 36% logic that we currently have.
Over in the chat room, Paul kind of framed an interesting question. I thought I would roll your way. If you don't have a direct answer, you can just speak in some general terms. But I think it is a good question because ultimately – regardless of what the laws and the regulations are and how they're written or how big the bureaucracy is and how many digits are after your N code or your J code, ultimately, especially in procurement, this is a cadre of civilian and military personnel that specialize in procurement, making things happen, working 3 years in a 12-year program before anything displaces water or makes a shadow on a ramp. And what is your view on our civilian and military procurement specialists, how they're educated, what their ethos is, how they work inside their bureaucracy? And is this something where we've pretty much got the best people we can with the best training we can given the structure we have? Or is there perhaps things that we could better do to train and prepare these people so when they step into that cubicle to manage these billion-dollar programs, that maybe they have a little bit of depth and nuance to their education to improve the position they're in?
Yeah, that's a really fantastic question. It's a really interesting question for me in part because one of the things I do in my job, my day job, is I'm a professor at a school that trains very nascent baby people who are going to go off to places like DOD and are going to go off and do things like procurement, not just for DOD but also for the intelligence community and so forth. And so, how we change thinking is a really interesting question to me. I guess my answer to it is this: that you can have the very best people. You can have the best educated people. You can have people who just know the ins and outs of every program. But if the institutional foundation of how you're approaching procurement is just fundamentally flawed, so just the incentives are all pointing in the wrong direction for not just the services, but also potentially for DOD. You can really have the best people in the world, but unless you can point them in the right direction, it's not going to solve the fundamental problems associated with procurement. And so I'm a little bit, I want the best procurement force, and I want the best trained and best educated, and I want them to have the right career incentives too. And there's a lot of potentially small bore reforms that that could be done, or I would expect if it's like any other bureaucracy, there are small bore reforms that could be done to improve the functioning. But as long as there are big picture questions that are leaving the institutions of national security pointing in the wrong direction or pointing into different strange corners, then the best workforce in the world isn't going to change that. And it's not necessarily going to solve the most basic procurement problems that we have.
When we look at the structure of the Department of Defense, and you've got a Secretary of Defense and his whole staff sitting on top of these other components, so let me play devil's advocate. Why is that not sufficient to deal with these sort of inter-service conflicts that you perceive? And I know that Secretaries of Defense have killed various major projects as time has gone on. As being not necessary, being too expensive, or whatever. Why are we not better at having that Secretary of Defense actually run the Defense Department and do exactly what you're talking about, which is coordinate these procurement activities and stop some of the spending for projects that seem to be totally service influenced, but not necessarily best for the entire country.
That's a really interesting question, and I think it has a lot to do. And this, comes back to some of the fundamental structure of American politics that limits the long-term interaction between politicians and the federal bureaucracy. And again, it's not something that's just an American problem. It's a problem with every country in the world, which is that there are lots of ways to outlast a Secretary of Defense, right, for a service to outlast. Secretary of Defense, and sometimes there are projects that a Secretary of Defense or President more generally kills or attempts to kill, but that don't stay dead. That's part of the problem is that the services understand and the people within the services understand, and they don't understand that they fundamentally believe they're right when they are approaching a Secretary of Defense who wants to kill a particular program. On the one hand, they just believe that Secretary of Defense is wrong. Generally, because the services are extremely good about understanding their own needs and inculcating their own needs within their workforces and within their people. And their people extend beyond the uniformed personnel of the service, right? There are people within the Pentagon who are fundamentally Air Force and Navy and so forth. And they understand that if they can weather the storm of a particular Secretary of Defense who wants to cancel a project, then their project can survive. And how long is the average tenure of the Secretary of Defense? Right? Very few of them manage to even get through a single presidential administration. So there's change. You can always wait for the next one, and you can always wait for the next presidential administration, even if you don't like that particular president. So that's problem number one. And I think problem number two with the Secretary of Defense is that SecDef has a lot on his plate. And even very successful, and I think the gloss may have come off a bit on Robert Gates, but there are still a lot of people who talk about Robert Gates as being the finest of the Secretaries of Defense. And if you read his book, I mean, there's no question he was deeply knowledgeable about every kind of defense program, and he has a deep understanding of American strategy that's really to be celebrated. But one of the decisions he made that people are now sort of coming back to is this decision to cancel the F-22, which looked great at the time, at least to a lot of people, including myself, and now looks to have been either premature or wrongheaded. But he did this because he had a short time frame, and he had to make short-term decisions about how to win the wars we were fighting. But even the Secretary of Defense, even a good Secretary of Defense, suffers from this short-termitis with respect to how they're making decisions about procurement programs.
Speaking of procurement programs, each service has, I don't know, to use a Lord of the Rings reference, has their precious. Where anything that is spoken or written that isn't full of adulation, praise, and support, you can always tell what the precious is, because the initial reaction is an emotional one, not a fact-based one, almost like you insulted somebody's parentage. And as a result, we all often have less than constructive discussion and behavior by people involved with it. And there's been one exception in the last couple of years And that has to do with the battle over the large deck carriers. And the pro and the con, at least in my little universe here, with almost the discussion of the pro and the con, I've almost chosen two team captains. You've got Brian McGrath, mm-hmm. and you have Jerry Hendricks. And we had the great rumble in the jungle there in Annapolis on the stage with the debate between the two of them. And that's given to a few more discussions by them. Some articles have been written. A few branches and sequels of the discussion have gone forth that I thought has been very constructive, mm-hmm. whether you are, you know, carriers forever, or the fact that, you know, we need to have a nice, easy transition to another structure. I thought that they've mm-hmm. outlined it well. They've comported themselves as gentlemen and it has set the tone. So there hasn't been a lot of acrimony outside of the few usual suspects in that discussion. And moving out of the Navy sphere, are there other really bold-faced items and the procurement world that really do set a theme on capabilities and approaches to delivering national will throughout the globe in the other services, you think is being handled in that type of, to use a lack of a better phrase, mature manner? And on the other side of the coin, what are those service-specific, bold-faced procurement items that you think does not have a constructive conversation? That's actually anti-intellectual, destructive, or smash mouth that are kind of demonstrate the other side of discussing / arguing these big ticket items.
Right. Well, first, I just want to say I completely agree with your characterization of the conversation between Brian and Jerry. I mean, they are both fantastic intellects, they're both deeply knowledgeable. My own preferences probably end up being slightly closer to Jerry's. I will use the term light aircraft carrier, and if you say that around Brian, he breaks out in hives. But So I always kind of return to the Air Force on these issues because the Air Force is one, of course, that I've studied a lot. And I don't mean particularly to pick on the Air Force with respect to these questions, but and I certainly don't think I'm the only one to make this argument. I don't know if you guys have ever had Tony Carr on the program. He's a retired Air Force officer, and he has a blog, I can't remember if it's called Public Intellectual or Public Interest or something along those lines, and he is a fantastic internal critic of a lot of Air Force thinking with respect to fighter aircraft, with respect to bombers, and with respect to attack aircraft. You know, in terms of the negative examples, I would say that, you know, where we are struggling to have a useful intellectual conversation, I would point to two Air Force programs, and the one isn't really a program. It's the question of what to do with the future of the A-10. And one thing that fascinates me about this debate is that the Air Force, it feels to me, has a much better case against the A-10 than it has ever really been willing to make. That, you know, if it simply trusted its personnel and trusted its argument, enough to make it with conviction, it would have a very good case about why the A-10 should be flown into the sunset. But instead, the Air Force has been extremely defensive with how it responds to criticism of its handling of the A-10. And this is the case not just in the last year or two, but recently, even over the past three or four decades with respect to the A-10. It's far more defensive than it needs to be. It's not putting its best foot forward and having a genuine, good intellectual debate about the future of this particular aircraft, about whether it has a future. And a second one is this capability that I think almost everybody agrees is really critical to the future of U.S. military capability, not just to U.S. air power, but to U.S. military capability, which is what the long-range strike bomber is going to look like, what kind of project that it's going to be, and how we're going to go about paying for it. And it feels like to me that the Air Force in particular has really closed ranks around this program and has decided, you know, we know that something's going wrong with the program, and we know that something can go wrong with the program, when all you hear about is what this particular project can do for us. And so with the LRSB, what we've been told is that it's going to be a bomber, it's going to be a drone, it's going to be a advanced reconnaissance aircraft, it's going to be advanced an advanced electronic warfare aircraft, an advanced electronic control, an airborne control aircraft. And what really did it for me was when, I can't remember who it was, but some Air Force general came up and said, it can even be an interceptor, right? We can even put air-to-air missiles on it, and it can go and then shoot down enemy aircraft, right? It can do all of these things. And then, I don't know if you saw it, the Mitchell Institute came out last week and said, we don't need just 100 of them, we need 200 of them. What this begins to feel like is not the kind of argument that we see about the future of the supercarrier versus the future of smaller platforms like big amphibs that you're seeing in the Navy, and is a really interesting, useful conversation. It begins to feel like just a marketing pitch, and a marketing pitch that is potentially destructive, because if you want LRSB to work, it has to work within a budget. And that means at some point you have to say, no, this aircraft cannot do this thing. Right, and we don't want this aircraft to do this thing. Right? It's going back to this with the Boyd and the reformers, right? Not a pound for air to ground, and that was really useful for them when thinking about the F-15, because it let them say no, it let them say no to people who wanted to add stuff onto the aircraft, and then that let them make a fantastic aircraft at a reasonable price. It doesn't feel to me right now that the Air Force is willing to say no about any capabilities that this theoretically low-priced aircraft is supposed to have. And that seems to me to be a recipe for just complete disaster with respect to what the final product is going to look like.
Well, but that's the fight that the Navy faces with its FA-18. When you start to make any aircraft deliver every function you can think of, can you do that? Or do you have to have the number of aircraft we used to have, where we had separate attack bombers and fighters. I mean, these are larger issues that are you have to, as we talked about earlier with your strategy, sometimes your tactical and strategic thought has to look forward to resolve these. But one of those issues that still lingers around is the Air Force and its long range bombers versus these the carrier based aircraft, and that fight doesn't seem to be going away. Is that when you talk about this being an advertising campaign that may hurt us, is that the sort of thing you're looking at that is disruptive to the successful procurement of all the services?
Right. I mean, I think that when a service commits itself to a marketing campaign, that's almost automatically destructive to joint warfighting, to inter-service conflict, but it's also destructive, and this is where I don't think there's enough realization. Turning a service project into a marketing campaign is destructive to that project, right? Making it absolutely central to the identity of a service, and this is the case whether you're talking about supercarriers or whether you're talking about long-range bombers, right? When the B-70 became so critical to the Air Force's identity that they had to have it, even though the strategic rationale for it had gone away, it was destructive to the service, right? It was destructive internally before it was canceled, and it was destructive after it was canceled. So that's always going to be bad. Now, what's interesting to me about, and I think Brian McGrath pointed us out very effectively, and he had a War on the Rocks article, was that you can't make, there's an argument that the Air Force struggles to make and the Navy struggles to make around these core capabilities, which is that you can't go to Congress and say, we need less of this other service so we can have more aircraft carriers. We need less Army so that we can have more aircraft carriers. We need less Navy so that we can have more long-range strike bombers. Right? That this is an argument that the services are allergic to. And it's because they know this argument is never going to be a winner, because I made this point in response to Bernie Sanders. People will tell you all the time, why should we buy bombers when we should be spending our money on schools? And it sounds kind of silly and it sounds kind of naive, but it's much easier for the United States to shift money between schools and long-range bombers than it is for the United States to shift money between aircraft carriers and long-range bombers, because each of these are so central to the identity of the services that, you know, that we should cancel an aircraft carrier so we can buy more LRSBs. It's a joke, right? It's an absurd claim, because budgeting is never done that way. You know, the services are interested in what they're interested in, and either the whole pie will increase, in which case both of them get more aircraft carriers and long-range strike bombers, or the whole pie will contract, in which both of them get fewer. But there's no strategic dialogue going on that says, no, we're going to rely on aircraft carriers flying something like an A-12 for a lot of our long-range strike capabilities, or no, we're going to make a concerted decision that the aircraft carrier is an obsolete technology and we're going to concentrate on these long-range strike aircraft. It's a conversation we can only have in the abstract, and we can't have it in practical terms because of the existing structure.
Well, as a professor, I'm going to give you an opportunity to do what all professors like to do, besides have people sit in chairs and be forced to listen to them. And that is to get a little subjective here. And even though I'm going to use the P word, I'm not being political here. I'm thinking very much in general terms. When people discuss strategy, and there's always been a frustration of mine. Our strategy's wrong. We don't have a strategy. Their strategy is this. A lot of people don't understand that the way it works is a nation's strategy first starts with its politics. What is the political guidance coming from those in power? And then the strategy derives from that political direction, and then everything goes from there, from your operational, your tactical, et cetera, and so forth. So it's not so much that a nation does not have a strategy. It just may not have a strategy that aligns to a certain person's political view or political agenda or political goals, and as such, they either don't understand or don't agree with the strategy. And when you look at a specific occurrence, if you look at what we've seen in the last few months in Syria, what Russia has been doing or not doing versus what the USA has been doing or not doing, both of them derive from a political structure and a political set of goals for both internal and external use. Is there anything as a useful compare and contrast from a political diplomatic point of view between what we're seeing Russia do right now versus what you see the U.S. doing in conjunction with both their traditional, non-traditional, and our former allies or adversaries?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and I guess that part of my answer is that I'm interested in what you guys think too. I mean, because I imagine that there's some difference of view in this. A lot of what looks like the difference between American and Russian strategy right now in Syria stems from the vastly different international positions that we're in at the moment. Russian action looks resolute, looks credible, looks effectual, and has been taken with, I think, a very forthright understanding of what they want to accomplish, and that's that they want the Syrian regime to survive. And that's, you know, overwhelming what they want, and they want to demonstrate the effectiveness of Russian power at the same time. Whereas the United States, as we know, remains very ambiguous about what we actually want. And far more clear, it seems to me, with respect to the means that we want to use, right, both in the negative and the positive, right? We are not looking so much for an outcome in Syria as we are looking to prevent the direct use of U.S. troops on the ground to either depose or to save the Syrian government. Both the Russian and the American are strategic in some sense, right? I mean, we both have very definite strategic goals. And I think the Obama administration also has in mind that it really wants to hold together the Asian pivot, and that's fundamentally what it's about. And it doesn't want to be distracted from the Asian pivot by the things that are always distracting it in the Middle East. But the way that plays out looks like a lack of strategy and a lack of attention, and that's especially destructive when it can't actually stop paying attention to Syria, right? However much it wants to stop paying attention to Syria, it doesn't want to be responsible for Syria. We are nevertheless the United States. And there was a wonderful Duffel Blog article a few weeks ago, and I think the headline was something along the lines of world whines for the United States to solve Syria problems so that world can complain about the United States, which is problematic, but is also quite accurate, a quite accurate description of how the world thinks about American power. And the Russians have a much more small bore intervention. They are dropping far fewer bombs and a lot less accurately than we are. But simply because of where they're starting out in terms of expectations, they look more credible, resolute, decisive.
Yeah, I thought that Duffel Blog article had more truth in it than it had satire. And we've all seen that in spades. And, you know, Rob, I think we're in pretty good alignment here. One thing that I've seen, the Russian side has been pretty straightforward for me. They have an ally. They have an opportunity with low risk to back them and to secure their foothold in the Eastern Med. And we'll figure out the rest as they go forward. But I think on the American side, and I've told, and some people don't like hearing it, but it's true, the American people voted twice for, and pretty clearly that they wanted to disengage, and they voted for a leader who also wants to disengage from the world. However, the world isn't quite letting him disengage, and you have an entire national security infrastructure through perhaps philosophically, but also through a matter of habit that because we are the USA, that they don't see how we can disengage, and we also have created a series of formerly strong and independent nations who have also developed a habit of expecting us to do their wet work and to take care of their dirty business. So, like Duffel Blog says, so then they can putt at us from the sidelines, and that has created a fair bit of a disconnect here. So I think we're in a rough alignment there, at least on the American side of the house, that it's hard to leave somebody when they won't let go of your ankle as you try to back out of the door. I don't know, Eagle One, what are your thoughts?
Well, the question I was going to ask, probably closely related to this, is how much of the problems we have with these issues are caused by the fact that we've basically been on a permanent war footing since, I'm going to say 1949, is it part of the problem that we just have never really had a period of peace to sort some of this stuff out?
I agree completely, right, that and I think that the since 19, you know, if we want to say permanent war footing for since 1941, really, that we have in essence, we have taken upon ourselves the same role that we took essentially in late 1941, which is that we're going to solve the problems and we're going to manage the world, we're going to manage the international system, and to some extent that's fine and it's laudable and it's worked out fine to, you know, I don't know if that's even a legitimate useful statement, but the hegemonic way that we have structured our national security system, the national security system, which was designed to first fight a global war against fascism and win a global war against fascism, and then was then structured and reconstructed and rebuilt to fight a global war against communism, and that then won a global war against communism, really is designed around finding global wars and fighting global wars. And it's very difficult to explain to this structure that, no, we're not fighting a global war, because it's going to find a global war to fight. And so restraint under that, within that framework is extremely difficult. I know from, and these are some of the people on a political side that's much closer to me in a lot of ways. There are lots of critiques from the left of the Obama administration that it's far too interventionist, it bombs far too many countries. And I tell these people, this is the most restraint you're ever going to see. Right? Never in your lifetime are you going to see an administration more restrained than this one, that's less interested in bombing than this one. So enjoy it while you have it. It's not going to come back. It's not going to be the next Democratic president. It's not going to be the next Republican president. This is your restraint. This is what you want. Enjoy it while you have it.
you go on. I don't know if the next question was mine or yours, but we still
I think I snuck my question in, so it's up to you.
Okay, over on my side of the house, continuing to pull on the strategy side of the house, there's been an interesting turn, and again, I don't want to make this a political show, but especially in election years, it's really interesting to see how quickly things can turn. With the attack in France, what had been a national security on the back burner, there's been a lot of discussions, well, you know, what if this does become a national security election? And it's interesting, there's one candidate that brings a bunch of national security and diplomatic experience to the table, but that record isn't anything you really want to put on a resume with the end results go. And besides what's going on in France, and I got some communications from friends of mine in Belgium, and that's a very interesting thing that's going on in Brussels right now as well. But besides the continual war footing against international terrorism going on, when the dust settles, literally and figuratively, and if we don't have any other major attacks, I really think that within 6 weeks, national security issues will go back to the back burner. Have you seen any additional traction that might move the discussion of the next year till the next election for national security to bring back up to the front? Or those of us who like to spend our intellectual efforts on the national security arena, should we accept the fact that our hobby horse will be a back issue?
Yeah, I almost always say the latter, that foreign policy is not going to have a really big effect on the election, and that's almost always right. There are certainly clear cases in which that wasn't, but you know, fundamentally, people in the United States have the luxury of not caring about foreign affairs. Right, it's what our hegemonic project has done. Right, that we are generally speaking safe from worrying about what other countries want to do to us. I think that the only thing that will bring it back, I don't think China's Great Wall of Sand is going to be very much of an issue in the election. The only thing that will really bring it back is some sort of longer term, more effective ISIS terrorism campaign against Europe. And the Paris attacks have really captured a lot of attention. And so if something happens late in the cycle leading up to the 2016 election, like an attack in Berlin or something similar to that, or God forbid an attack in the United States, then I think very much it could come back and be something that's important. On the other hand, you know, even if somehow U.S.-supported forces took Raqqa and utterly quashed ISIS, success doesn't play nearly as well as failure in this kind of thing. And so the Democrats really don't have much of a hand to play here, right? If they crush ISIS, then ISIS stops being an issue and nobody cares. And so from a political point of view, the Democrats have landmines, but they can at least hope that people won't really be paying attention when they're casting votes.
Well, Jerry Hendricks has posed an interesting question in the chat room, which is, which presidential candidate, in your mind, is most open to innovation and change if it's required in our defense structure?
That's a really interesting question. So part of it sort of depends on who we still consider to be a presidential candidate. You know, of the announced presidential candidates, if somehow Rand Paul managed to move past 1% of the vote, I think that the way he approaches thinking about government would be open to, and this is not to say that I would vote for Rand Paul, even though he's my senator, but I think he would be the most open to some questions about defense reform, right, because of just of the way he approaches thinking about government. and so that would be number one. Second, and again, this not because I would support, but I would be really fascinated, almost from sort of an outsider, oh my goodness, that's fun to watch point of view, with what Donald Trump would do with government, because I just have no idea. Sort of the way that he might attempt to go at the bureaucracy. the more conventional candidates, I think, are all going to be more conventional, right? Rubio and Clinton and Bush. I don't think you can expect serious institutional reform in the defense from any of them. And it would be a mistake to expect that they would do much in terms of reforming the national security state.
Well, on that note, Rob, we're coming near the end of the show, and besides your eventual success of sticking a stake through the heart of the U.S. Air Force, I know there are some other areas that you're working on, and we outlined early on the show where people can get some of your writings if they want to dig more into Dr. Robert Fowler's brain. But where is a good place for them to go here towards the end of the year and going into 2016 to read what you're putting out there? And do you have some big projects that you're going to be working on that people should keep an ear out for as well?
Right. I continue to publish pretty regularly at The Diplomat, Asia Pacific, and at The National Interest. And I also have Lawyers, Guns, and Money, which is the now venerable Lawyers, Guns, and Money. For those of you who are interested in battleships, I have a new book that is supposed to be out, but is still supposed to be coming out, called The Battleship Book, through Wildside Press. And so if you're interested in a take, then go ahead and search for Amazon and see if you can find that. The next big project for me is the one that I'm working on right now, is looking at intellectual property law, and how intellectual property law affects military acquisition and the transfer of military technology. So that's something that I think we could talk about more in the future, because it's a really interesting deep bore debate about how IP law and military technology work together.
And there we go. And hey, I do appreciate you taking time out this Sunday, and I look forward to your book on battleships. That's why on the pre-show I had to put up the most ridiculous superstructure of any battleship ever made, the Imperial Japanese Navy Fuso. That's just, I don't know if that's a pagoda or somebody just had too much sake with the welding torch, but that is one ugly superstructure. But we look forward to that as well, and I hope you have a great holiday season, Rob.
All right. Well, thanks for having me on.
Thanks a lot,
thanks
Rob.
Thank you very much.
Happy Thanksgiving.
There
we go.
I appreciate
gobble,
it.
Gobble, gobble. And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats, and we look forward to seeing you next time you visit. Until then, hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Molly wrote on neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, let us swear. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.